I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Many knew him as the most trusted man in America, but how well did you really know Walter Cronkite? Today, Rice University history professor Douglas Brinkley talks about his new biography of Cronkite. Using material from the Cronkite Archive and over 200 interviews, Brinkley reveals a different side to the news anchor respected by millions. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Once upon a time, a one-time Kansas Cityan was known as the most trusted man in America. Yes, I'm talking about Walter Cronkite, the longtime anchorman for CBS News, who just happened to be the uncle of former Kansas City Mayor Kay Barnes. Born in St. Joseph, Cronkite soon moved to Kansas City, where he was fascinated by the city's streetcar system and became a Kansas City Star delivery boy, dreaming that one day he would write stories that appeared on the front page. His fame instead came in the relatively new medium of television, where his nearly nonstop coverage of the Kennedy assassination riveted the nation. Rice University history professor Douglas Brinkley has written a new biography of Cronkite titled simply Cronkite. He's written books on World War II and John Kerry and edited President Reagan's diaries. He's a history commentator for CBS News and a contributing editor to Vanity Fair. He speaks at the library tonight, and he's right here in the studio with me this morning. Doug, nice to have you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, some say he was at his absolute best in the coverage of the Kennedy assassination back in 63. He obviously didn't relish the notion that the president had been shot, but he relished the journalistic moment, I guess. How good was he during those hours, Doug?
Well, Walter Cronkite did an amazing job of guiding us through that tragedy. I call him in my book sort of a pastor-in-chief or a handholder. or babysitter, because we're all glued to what Walter Cronkite had to tell us next. And it's a very iconic moment when he takes his glasses off and looks at the clock as if to mark it for history, and yet is, he's tearing up in his eyes. But he goes on, after announcing the death of Kennedy, to cover that whole weekend, which was who shot Kennedy?
Yeah.
Who is Lee Harvey Oswald? Who is Jack Ruby, who just killed Oswald? What's going on with Jackie Kennedy? What's Lyndon Johnson doing? How is he going to get sworn in? Where's the body going to be buried, in Massachusetts or at Arlington? And all of that drama, Cronkite earned the nickname Iron Pants because he would just stay on for this marathon broadcasting. And we should have known it by 63 because of John Glenn in 62 became a marathon broadcast. But when a big special event, a news-shattering event was going to happen, TV now was going to run for this long bit, almost like you have today with 24-hour cable news.
Well, let's go back and listen to Walter Cronkite, the moment he actually announced the death of President Kennedy. And again, as Douglas Brinkley just said, he removes his glasses, takes a long pause, and then tells the nation the news here.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
You know, the amazing thing about those moments, Doug, is you wonder if he choreographed it, because he clearly found a way to connect with America at one of those incredibly pivotal moments.
Well, Walter Cronkite loved drama. He was he loved it as a boy here in Kansas City, and when he went to University of Texas for college, he was part of the Curtain Club. Actually used to say, I want to be a vaudevillian, a song and dance man. And his hero was Lowell Thomas, who some of your listeners might remember, but, you know, the legendary, intrepid Lowell Thomas. And Cronkite had a bit of a showman in him. Now, when you get to that what happened with the Kennedy assassination, all I found out at NBC, for example, they were saying, uh-oh, Cronkite's going teary, because they did it so seriously. And then what the Cronkite's genius was, he slowed it down like a muddy old river.
Yeah. He spoke actually a certain number of words a minute. He trained himself to go there.
The trolley you were mentioning here in Kansas City, yeah. And his loving of how they would run on time. He wanted his word. He would say, today in Dallas. And it gave it more meaning. Yeah. Now, I talk quickly. And most of us do, you know, particularly if you're in the communications field, mm-hmm. you know, you want to have to keep going. But Cronkite just kept pulling back like a jazz musician who just knew how to take the tempo down a beat. I just came from visiting the wonderful Kansas City Jazz Museum here. Mm, and
yeah.
I was watching the film, and Shirley Horn, a great pianist, vocalist, was talking about the need. It just, we slowed it down, that we caught a kind of rhythm, and then you could ride it out. And Cronkite's broadcast had that same feel.
You know, even at that moment, and obviously our listeners were just listening and not watching, but Cronkite was not wearing a sport coat. He was in shirt sleeves, the sleeves rolled up, and again, glasses on, glasses off, speaking in a way that was very much connecting with people out there.
And he had his jacket there so he could have put it on. So why doesn't he? Because he wanted to be the working journalist. He wanted to be working the story. By not yeah. having the coat on, it explained that we were caught by utter surprise. That morning, it was a Friday when Kennedy was shot in Dallas. Cronkite had brought in a little tub of pineapple mixed with cottage cheese, which was eating his lunch. And one of the things in the news business, there are always lulls. It was a very no-news Friday when suddenly, boom, that happened. And at that moment, an adrenaline rush has to come in and your sense of professionalism has to kick in. If he had gone out for a long lunch and didn't eat in, somebody else may have at CBS been in the newsroom to have done that. But Cronkite liked to hang out in the newsroom because he knew that kind of thing could always happen.
You know, and not to belabor the point too much here, but he really hesitated to announce the news. I mean, at one point, a few minutes before, he pinned the possible death of President Kennedy on Dan Rather, attributing it to Rather. So if Rather is wrong by any chance, it's Rather who gets hung out to dry and not the anchor man himself.
What was it Martin Luther King Jr. said? Longevity has its virtues. Cronkite wanted a career of longevity. You know, you make one bad mistake, like you miss a pre-announced a president dead, you're toast.
Yeah.
Rather, being a young buck trying to get in the game, and Dan's personality was always a little more hyper-caffeinated and wanted to beat everybody, which yeah. is what you want for a reporter in some ways. Went early and said, hey, let's go. I got it. I've talked to this person. I'm confident. But Cronkite wouldn't go with it. And when he eventually did, he said, according to one CBS reporter, Dan Rather, he is telling us, giving himself that wiggle room. If it turns out it's like, oh, boy, we had a bad reporter down there. Sorry, I'm still Walter Cronkite.
Yeah. You know? Well, so just how influential ultimately was Walter Cronkite?
He was the giant of American journalism from World War II on down. From Kansas City here, he moved to New York and then went and served in World War II and was our United Press reporter, and he embedded with the 8th Air Force. Now, on radio, you just say something like the 8th Air Force. I asked people to look them up online. I mean, they're called the Mighty 8th. And they did these incredible bombing raids, fighting air wars against Germans' Luftwaffe, and did bombings of all industrial facilities in Germany. Cronkite embedded with them and even flew on missions with them. One of his close buddies, Bob Post, a New York Times reporter, got killed. His close friend Andy Rooney of Stars and Stripes almost got killed. Cronkite also crash-landed on a glider into a Dutch potato field for what's known as Operation Market Garden. And, you know, was there in Luxembourg and Brussels and was in the Netherlands for its liberation in Rotterdam and Amsterdam and the like. And he went on after World War II to stay and cover the Nuremberg trials of putting away the Nazi war criminals. All I'm suggesting is by a very young age, he was part of all of the big events of our time, which for a historian like myself makes him incredibly interesting. Add to that, he wasn't just an eyewitness to the Nuremberg trial or was bureau chief of an early Cold War Russia with Stalin, covering Stalin. He kept notes. And scholars, we love other people's mail. My late friend Stephen Ambrose said, historians are people that read other people's mail. Well, Cronkite wrote to his wife Betsy here in Kansas City. She stayed in Kansas City during World War II. And he wrote her a letter every other day. Vivid descriptions of what was going on in London and the press corps. Now, some of it was censored material, but just long, delightful writers because he was a good writer. So when you're getting hundreds of letters from Walter Cronkite sent here to Kansas City, it's a trove of material for a historian to reconstruct in chapters what it would have been like to have been a foreign embedded correspondent during World War II.
We're talking with historian Douglas Brinkley about his new book on Walter Cronkite. You know, in speaking about how influential he was, there's just a great moment in this book, a set of pages in which you describe Cronkite in Egypt to cover the assassination of Anwar Sadat. And he's already at this point in my story here has gotten this major scoop with an interview with Mubarak, Sadat's successor. And then you describe Walter Cronkite determined to get a joint interview with the three presidents who have been sent to Egypt to represent this country, Ford, Carter, and Nixon. And he goes to the hotel to see these presidents, Doug, and you know this so well. He gets to the hotel and it's jam-packed with people, reporters, all wanting to get a piece of these presidents. And Cronkite walking up onto this scene, you describe him as like Moses parting the waters. People see Cronkite coming, move out of the way to make room for this icon coming to interview the presidents. The Secret Service guys, he's talking to them. Hey, how you guys doing? Thanks for doing what you're doing. Mr. Cronkite, nice to see you again. And he walks right up into the hotel because he's Walter Cronkite. That's how influential he was.
Absolutely. And, you know, he can insinuate himself into any situation. Yeah. And everybody recognized him. They didn't need his ID. And so he was always so kind to the working crews, Secret Service groups, and signing autographs or BSing.
Hello,
with them.
Fellas.
Hello, yeah. Fellas. That he could walk right in, like they could be in the middle of a president. Nobody was going to keep Walter Cronkite out of the room.
And then Jody Powell, the President Carter's former press secretary, runs out and greets Cronkite and says, "Walter, you've done it again," referring to his scoop getting the interview with Mubarak, which I guess is already aired at that
he
point.
He did, and he met all three presidents. And the odd part was that Nixon
greeted him. Yeah.
Who Cronkite had a war with Nixon over Watergate, because after Woodward and Bernstein's breaking journalism in the Washington Post, that was back page news. I interviewed both Woodward and Bernstein. I was just with Bernstein the other day. Mm-hmm. But they were hanging out there, and Walter came in, took their work, and put 17 minutes of a half an hour broadcast to Watergate before any other national group took it seriously. And then he did another like 13-minute Watergate piece. That's what made Watergate Watergate. And I've listened to the Nixon tapes, the White House tapes, and I can't wait for readers to just see this vendetta of getting Cronkite. Chuck Colson wanted to bust him, who was working with Nixon, because his popularity had gotten so large, Nixon, that they couldn't keep him under control. And the idea was, if you can damage Uncle Walt, you know, then these other
you can win.
Reporters will cower, mm-hmm. and you can win. And instead, he just kept getting more popular. And finally, Nixon resigned, and there's Cronkite covering Nixon's resignation. But cut to the story that you're talking about after Anwar Sadat's death, Nixon rushed up to him, and instead of having animosity, just said, Walter, oh, do you remember when we were here? These these punks weren't here, but we were back here when Nasser took us down the Nile. You and I have been pros for a long time.
I was amazed by that.
Look at all these young bucks running around here now that think they remember history. Suez Canal, Walter, remember?
Yeah.
He's 56.
Yeah.
You know? And so it just showed you how embedded Cronkite was with the establishment, and even in how everybody liked Walter and Betsy Cronkite, even when you had moments of adversarial gamesmanship with him.
Well, Doug, let's get our listeners involved here and have them call right now. Perhaps you knew Walter Cronkite from his days in Kansas City, or perhaps you have memories of why you regarded him as perhaps the most trusted man in America. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. You know, you may have described him as Moses at one point, Doug, but he was not without his flaws, and you point them out in this book. Even some of his fellow journalists, this surprised me a little bit, suggested that he wasn't the toughest interviewer around.
Cronkite was a fairly softball interviewer because, you know, his style was so avuncular. I would equate him to more of a Larry King-like approach. But remember, Larry King, think what you want, stayed on for a long time and probably interviewed everybody. That approach gets you somewhere. It means you let other people, you're not trying to pull something controversial out of them, let them hang themselves with enough verbiage.
Mm-hmm.
That was the Cronkite's approach. It was much different than Mike Wallace's colleague. Wallace believed you go for the jugular, you throw in the person off,
right,
off their seat. And each style has its moments, and it depends on the personality. But Cronkite was a good interviewer, but he didn't ask the tough follow-ups. And certainly Barbara Walters, for example, is considered a far more superior interviewer on extracting information than Cronkite was.
Did it bother him that he was regarded that way?
It did. He got angry because people thought he was too soft, and he would bristle when it was said. If he bristled right now at what I'm saying, because he felt he was as tough as he needed to be. But we are living in a world of I gotcha journalism, and people want to, you know, just look at a press conference with Barack Obama and look at the questions the president yesterday I saw just getting, you know, trying to trip up, you know, the White House. Cronkite wouldn't do that. He would simply ask a more straight question like, you know, what are you going to be doing tonight at the fundraiser?
Yeah.
You know, or what are you going to? And so it was a style, older generation style. But Mike Wallace was of his generation and had a different one. Chris Wallace today on Fox is another one of these tough interviewers, and Tim Russert was. But Cronkite is much more like Brokaw, I would say, trying to play the American grain, always seems to be pulling for Team America and hoping who he interviews does well.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Paul from Overland Park. Paul, you're on with Douglas Brinkley. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, are you familiar with when Walter Cronkite did the You Are a There series on television somewhere in the 50s, where the idea was there was a bunch of reporters at memorable historical events, assassination of William Caesar, Julius Caesar, and say the trial of Wirtz there, the Swiss-American commandant of the infamous Confederate prisoner camp.
Right.
Anyway, if you were familiar with those, I remember watching those. It gave me a great interest in history and so forth. I don't know how real the events were depicted. I suspect they tried. But anyways.
Yeah, well, thank you, Paul. And you don't see those kinds of TV shows on
anymore. You know, You Were There was in the 50s, became a very popular show. And it was Walter Cronkite interviewing Napoleon Bonaparte or Louis Pasteur or Paul Revere after his
ride. It's like Crosby Kemper, who heads our library here, does a similar series here in Kansas City.
Well, you know, it's a very great way to learn history. And what was really cool about what they did with that show was it was historically exact. It got vetted and fact-checked to such an almost obsessive degree that it really is an educational tool and was used in the 60s in schools. Even now, some teachers use them as a way to draw particularly young people into learning about the past. I write about this a lot in my book, but Sidney Lumet became the director, really, or the idea of all of this. Now, Lumet went on to make great Hollywood films, including Network.
Yeah,
which is somewhat modeled on Cronkite going, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore. There's a great connection, but more to the point, Edward R. Murrow at CBS in his show See It Now started going after Joe McCarthy and that became a big deal. Cronkite was a little scared to go after Joe McCarthy like that, but he was against McCarthy. So he hired for You Are There three blacklisted writers. And so the actual script writers of You Were There are people that have been blacklisted by the McCarthy group. So it was Cronkite's bit of defiance. And then on the show itself, you would have things like how bad persecutions of people were.
Mm-hmm.
The Dreyfus affair in France, Joan of Arc burned at the stake. And so it was subliminal mm-hmm. that this is not good what Joe McCarthy's doing for history. And it's way Cronkite has survived his reputation of being a player in the McCarthy era. That's not front tier, but coolly second tier. At the same time, he adapts the space race with the Soviets and NASA as his calling card and career calling card. And he rides that NASA jet fume all the way to fame with Alan Shepard and John Glenn and beyond.
We'll talk more about that in our second half today. Allison from Fairway. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning, Steve. I have some real memories of Walter Cronkite, who was from St. Joe. That's where I grew up and went to high school.
Mm.
His aunt, Dorothy Cronkite, was my principal at Eugene Field Elementary School.
Wow.
And he was a real hero at St. Joe, of course. And, of course, K. Waldo Barnes is related to him. Everybody knows that. But what I remember when I was in high school, I was on the Central High School newspaper staff, and he came to St. Joe to the Rubidoux Hotel, which has been torn down, and had a news conference, or he was just invited to be there, and I was lucky enough to get to go, and it was just a wonderful experience. It was really inspirational. I told your person I spoke to that it was right at the time, it was mid 1968, the Vietnam War, things were getting controversial. He handled all the questions that were asked of him with such poise and professionalism, and I missed that. He was my newscaster. He's who I listened to every night. I saw everything that happened in the world in the 60s, from Walt Cronkite's eyes, from Woodstock to John F. Kennedy, and wish there were more people like him in the news today.
Allison, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It really is a passing of an era. We don't have Cronkites today like we used to have,
Doug. Well, we don't. And you may have been at a very historic exchange, depending on the year you're talking about in St. Joe's, because after Apollo 11 in July, August 69, Spiro Agnew, vice president, started going after the press. And he went to Iowa Agnew and started just ripping in, particularly to Big Three News, liberal bias. Cronkite's response was to fly to St. Joe's and do this huge town hall, kind of not huge, but a town hall format, which was filmed by CBS.
Right.
And it became interpreted from St. Joe's as Cronkite representing all the Fourth Estate's response to the bullying of Spiro Agnew. And out of that St. Joe's exchange, which CBS carried live, I mean, it'll be like a C-SPAN event today, but they said they made Agnew's speech a big, and then it's Cronkite's response big.
Wow.
And it's the beginning of the end of Spiro Agnew, because Cronkite now is warring with what the Nixon White House is trying to do, control and manipulate media, and became really an Edward R. Murrow figure in his own right, defending Fourth Estates right here in St. Joe's. And I hope tonight at the library, friends of Cronkite and family, I know some who are coming, because I came here on book tour. This is sort of a homecoming for the great journalist of 20th century America.
And you wrote this book with their cooperation.
I did, and they've been a big help. Walter Cronkite had three children, Chip, Kathy, and Nancy. They've all been very helpful. I live in Austin, Texas, and Kathy lives there, so I see her regularly. She was at my house not too long ago.
And how did they react to the book?
They liked it. I let them read it in galley. Mm-hmm. They had a couple of things that made them cringe, but they gave me a big thumbs up. They knew I did the work, and it's vetted and, all of that. And Chip Cronkite and I have become very close friends, his only son. And Walter Cronkite's grandson works for Bob Schieffer at CBS Face the Nation and is covering the campaign. And he's like 22 years old. And he has that same charisma that his granddad had. It maybe skipped a generation. Not that the Cronkite's kids don't have the charisma, but this grandkid who Walter favored tremendously. He brought him to the White House with them. He took him on the yacht with Bill and Hillary Clinton. And he's only 22, but he saw a lot and as a young man. And I think he's going to become a big journalist star.
What made the family cringe that's in this book?
Well, I'm writing about some of his drinking escapades, having to deal with the fact that after Betsy died, Walter took up with Joanne Simon, who is Carly Simon's, the singer's sister, and they moved in together. So here's a man in his 80s who's been with, you know, moved in with her. She's a wonderful woman, and, you know, I had to bring her into the last, you know, 10 years of Walter Cronkite's life. And probably there's a story in here about the problem Cronkite got into with a Pan Am junket where it was James Michener, the novelist, and Art Buchwald, the columnist, and Cronkite, all their friends were friends with somebody at Pan Am, Lewis Player, and Player got them all to travel to Tahiti and go snorkeling and go to Haiti. Cronkite saw it as an opportunity to see a lot of the world and not stick a bill to CBS.
Yeah.
Collect information for story ideas. That was his excuse. Well, the newsroom, Dick Salant, president of CBS, thought of it as a junket and took Cronkite to the woodshed. But it was just a big black mark in-house on Cronkite, and he never replicated that again. But this friendship he had with a particular company, Pan Am, caused him some trouble a couple times in his life.
The other thing that caused him some issues over the years, Doug, was this notion that, as you describe him here in your book, he was a through-and-through Democrat, you know, really all along, whose impartiality was questioned during the 64 presidential election when Lyndon Johnson faced Barry Goldwater. And there were critics out there who said Cronkite was out to get Goldwater.
Well, that's right. Look, Walter Cronkite was his whole life personally, and again, it's hard, but I'm disconnecting professionalism because we need to do his job just like you do here. You're a pro, and you're trying to strike a balance.
We try.
And, you know, so Cronkite did a good job at that personal life. He was a New Deal FDR Democrat, loved Harry Truman, who was, I think, his favorite president. He worshipped Truman. His first presidential interview was with Truman in 51, and Truman gave him a tour of the White House. Because he was a hometown, two hometowners, you know, they hit it off pretty well. Eisenhower he got along well with because Bill Paley, the owner and founder of CBS, worked for Ike during World War II, and Cronkite befriended Ike during the Normandy period as a war correspondent. But by 64, when Barry Goldwater and the conservative movement reared up, Cronkite just thought Goldwater was out to lunch, a reactionary, not fit to have nuclear weapons in his hands, and was very fearful of him. And it seeped into some of his broadcast.
And you wonder how he would have fared during that period in this contemporary media age of blogs and Twitter posts and everything else, because there was actually some organized opposition to his reporting in those days.
If he were at this age now, he would probably be seen, you know, in TV culture, he'd probably be seen as, you know, a liberal anchor who was good, you know, maybe a Tom Brokaw kind of figure. But the Goldwater, when he went to the Cow Palace in San Francisco in 64, the Goldwater people flipped him off and booed him. And he didn't do well in San Francisco, so he got yanked from the Democratic, covering the Democratic convention in Atlantic City. And they put Trout Mudd instead, Bob Trout, an old veteran reporter.
And Roger Mudd.
Roger Mudd. And they didn't do much better. And actually, Cronkite won because he got this exclusive with Lady Bird Johnson about what it was really like in the Johnson White House. That became the dominant story. There was no drama in Atlantic City. Everybody knew it was going to be Lyndon. And so Cronkite weathered that career storm of being too anti-Goldwater and goofing up in the summer of 64. Back in strong form by 65 and never turned back. And when he quit in 1981, was the top-rated anchor and most beloved TV personality of his time.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about Walter Cronkite's farewell address to the nation, which was somewhat anticlimactic, the tensions that existed between he and Dan Rather, and we'll also talk about his ties to Kansas City and St. Joseph. I should point out that Doug Brinkley speaks tonight at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library on the plaza at 6:30. The event is nearly at capacity. More information about that event on our website, kcur.org, or go to the library's website. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed Monday's talk about women in politics, you'll find it in all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, we know we're going to get it, but what do we do with it? A conversation about uses for ultra-high-speed Google Internet service here in Kansas City. This hour, we're talking with Douglas Brinkley about his new biography of Walter Cronkite. It's titled Simply Cronkite. He speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library and the Plaza. The event is almost at capacity. More information about that on our website, kcur.org. The book Cronkite is just a terrific read. Doug, why did you want to do the book? You've done World War II books. You edited Ronald Reagan's papers. Why a book on Walter Cronkite?
Well, I grew up in Ohio, and we watched the Cronkite broadcast every night, and we would have supper, and then there it was. And so my mom has all these drawings that I've kept when I was, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, and everything I drew was reflected of what I saw on the Cronkite set.
Wow.
So, you know, Vietnam and all of that. Then I was with the writer David Halberstam, who passed recently. He wrote famously a book called The Powers That Be, which is our best book about the media culture. And in driving with him, he said Cronkite was the most significant journalist. This mm-hmm. comes from the great Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times writer.
Yeah.
And we talked about that. Somebody said, that's who somebody should do a biography of. It's like our times. My generation's time is Cronkite, meaning we grew up during World War II, and we're there in our early 20s. But then we had Korea, and then we had, you know, the McCarthy era and Eisenhower and everything up to now. And Cronkite just died in 2009. He was sort of our filter through history. And all of his papers just opened at the University of Texas, and it's just a massive amount of material to pick through, letters, correspondence to people, press releases. So it seemed to me to be a perfect way to look at the 20th century through its ace reporter.
Yeah. He was born in St. Joseph, but he always considered Kansas City his hometown. Why?
Well, he's born in St. Joe, and now it came from a family of dentists. They didn't just move here. They have a couple generations in Missouri and Kansas. His father, during World War I, had to leave Kansas City area to go to Europe. He was a dental surgeon, and the family moved into Kansas City to be have more closer to relatives.
Yeah, yeah.
And at that point, his father came back, and they stayed here for a while. And as you mentioned, Walter Cronkite was a paper boy here. Then his father got a job offer to work at the Texas Dental School in Houston, and they drove their car from here, leaving all their Walter's grandparents were still here, and the family kind of went out to Houston where they knew nobody. And after a while, his father had trouble with the racism in Houston. The Jim Crow and the KKK was very big, 1927, 28 when they were there. And then his father started drinking too much, and there was problems with the marriage, and a divorce ensued. And he moved back to Kansas City and opened up a dental practice while Walter stayed with his mother in Houston. Hmm. But as soon as he got out of there, he kept aiming to come back to KC. And he did a little stint at University of Texas, then moved back to Kansas City, Walter Cronkite, to be near his father, to be with his relatives. And he met Betsy Maxwell, who had graduated from the University of Missouri at Columbia Law School. They fell in love. They got married. She was a reporter also and wrote columns for women's columns and self-help columns for the newspaper. And he got hired by KCMO Radio and did radio for a while. And then when that didn't work, he ran the United Press desk out of Kansas City. And this became his grand central station in life. He loved Kansas City. He wanted to help remodel the city and help save the train station a decade ago. It was one of his big pet causes. And, of course, was here for the 150th anniversary at Arrowhead Stadium, along with Little Richard, which I thought was odd, was performing. But this was where he loved it the most, the Paris of the West, Kansas City. This is where he told people he was from. He was born right here and is buried here.
He's the only child.
Only child.
He was fascinated with our streetcar system. What was he so fascinated about?
It was the beginning of his interest in transportation. It's why he loved aviation and space. He just was a buff of transportation, but also that fact that they ran on time. And timing is what he mastered. He would have his stopwatch with them, It's the greatest artifact. I have it in its archive. I've held it. And he would say, okay, you've got, like you have to do with your program, you have 15 minutes. You got that stopwatch going. So you pace yourself and you know you got to stop at the exact second. You don't want to go over. And he started structuring his life almost like a trolley car, you know, very, very much knew exactly where he timing things. He didn't bleed things into each other, except when he went out to sea in his sailboat and he put the stopwatch in a drawer and he was able to just live a kind of more normal life.
He never graduated from college. Why didn't that slow him down?
Well, you know, his daughter told me, she said one day, Dad, you see, college is overrated. You didn't need a degree and you've become, you know, you won an honorary doctorate from Harvard as a college dropout. He said, oh, but if I would have completed and got my degree, I would have been bigger than the Kaiser.
Just that simply. Yeah. It certainly didn't slow him down, though.
Didn't slow him down because he had a trade. Mm-hmm. And I think we underestimate, a lot of people talk about career. And we maybe should be retraining people to have a trade you love because it will never leave you. If somebody's listening and is an electrician or a carpenter or a woodworker, you have your trade. His trade was broadcasting. And he loved – he read all the books about broadcasting and loved all meeting all the people. He had that trade. And no matter what, he could apply it in bad times because he had mastered the behind-the-scenes aspects of news broadcasting. He was, after all – not just the anchor man of CBS for all these years, but the managing editor. He gave the assignments out. Mm-hmm. He was like a big city newspaper editor, except his program was CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. But he's the one who said, well, let's do civil rights. Let's cover the environment. You know, let's deal with you know, what's going on in China. Whatever it was, Cronkite was determining the power of what we'd be seeing in our living rooms every night.
Yeah, and it seemed like he was just destined to become a journalist. Now, you talk about him delivering the Kansas City Star as a boy and dreaming of having stories on the front page of the paper someday.
Well, he did, but he learned a big lesson early here in Kansas City because he saw a paper he was delivering that said Warren Harding, President Harding, dies in San Francisco. And he wanted to be Mr. Breaking News. So he ran everywhere. Look at this face. And they showed a picture of Harding on the Star. You'll never see that man again. Yeah. Well, Cronkite would later say, well, of course we can see footage of him. We're going to see the face again. I was misreporting the death of Harding as if that was the last time he'd ever get to glance his face. He hadn't developed intellectually enough. He said it as a joke, but he would constantly come back here and, of course, got married here. As I mentioned, with Betsy in town, and they had their first child, you know, born here, and this became home. It is their home. And so I've been in New York, D.C., Boston, doing East Coast, and immediately wanted to get out here to Kansas City before I returned to my own family, because this seems to me to be a Kansas City book.
Walter Cronkite is our topic today. Douglas Brinkley is our guest. He's the author of a new book on Cronkite titled Simply Cronkite. He speaks at 6:30 tonight at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. Our number here to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Perhaps you knew Walter Cronkite from his days in Kansas City. Brian writes us this. I used to work as a ferry boat as a deckhand out of Greenwich Harbor in Connecticut. And I always got a kick out of seeing Walter every weekend sailing his yawl. He always wore a hat with a brim and sunglasses, and he always waved back at me. He loved to sail, didn't he?
He loved to sail, and he loved to wave back to people.
Yeah.
Cronkite, as Dan Rather said to me, would talk to a potted plant. Walter loved talking to people, waving, smiling. And what was so hilarious is Andy Rooney, was his best friend in life, and they would go as a team to talk on World War II issues or something. And in an airport, everybody would come up to both of them together, and with Cronkite would say, "How are you? Where are you from, young man? You know, you know, what are you looking to do? What are your aspirations?" And sign an autograph and all. And the same person would say, "Oh, and hey, Mr. Rooney, I love you in 60 Minutes," and Rooney would say, "Buzz off." So their styles were about
a little bit different,
polar opposite, but they were the ultimate odd couple.
He became the anchor at CBS News. How, Doug?
He took over in April of 1962 over Douglas Edwards at CBS because Edwards just wasn't competing properly with the Huntley-Brinkley challenge at NBC. And there were all sorts of considerations who should fill in for Edwards, Charles Kuralt, Howard K. Smith, Harry Reasoner among them. And Cronkite scored the coup with John Glenn in February of 62 because Cronkite had gotten that space beat down so well. Glenn became maybe our country's first authentic hero since Audie Murphy in World War II. I mean, we can't – today, young people don't realize how big Glenn was. It was like Lindbergh. And Cronkite did this masterful job of guiding us through it all and pausing and bringing drama and, oh, my – oh, golly, there she goes. You know, it's off. And
he was so excited about it.
He made it riveting. And so he became so big that he became the natural person. America had fallen in love with Walter Cronkite. And by 63, September, it becomes a half-an-hour news broadcast, and that changes – the way we play out the 60s, because the back of the story bits became civil rights, because Cronkite thought there was great drama in Martin Luther King. And they would start covering on CBS, Selma, Birmingham, you know.
And the broadcast had just been 15 minutes prior to that time.
They wouldn't have had time to cover CBS. They wouldn't have that. But instead, they created a Southern Bureau and dispatched four or five reporters, including Dan Rather, who did some of his best work, Roger Mudd on segregation, and Bill Plant, who's still with CBS right now, and a man, Nelson Benton, who has a journalism school named after him in Charlotte, North Carolina. Great Southern correspondence bringing us the civil rights into our living room.
Back to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888. Fred from Kansas City, Missouri. You're on with Douglas Brinkley. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. I live over behind Paseo High School on 47th Terrace. And the urban legend over there is that on the 1800 block of East 47th Terrace used to be the house where Walter Cronkite grew up as a child. And I just want to know if that was true or not.
Yes, that's the neighborhood. I don't know the particular structure. I once got to go by it, but yes, you're right where he ended up. He grew up.
Okay. Well, I've heard stories about him from some of the...
Let's get a plaque put up.
We should.
The city of Kansas City needs to do something for Cronkite.
That's right.
I would think a statue at the library or something maybe around the plaza, you know, that could be – because people care about him, and you would have a – you know, I just was down by the Charlie Parker's, you know, stuff at the Jazz Museum and all. Well, you guys need to claim Cronkite here in Kansas City.
Well, you you come on down, and he lives just down the street from the asylum.
Yeah. Fred, thanks for the phone call. Maybe he can start the campaign to get a statue or some sort of commemoration for Walter Cronkite in Kansas City. Kevin from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Hi there, good morning.
Hi.
I too, great show, by the way. I, too, am originally from St. Joe, and I got to tell you a couple of things. One, those of us who are from three things, those of us who are from St. Joe are pretty proud of the fact that Walter Cronkite and the Cronkites came from there. Two, we more than a little bit resented that he claimed he was from Kansas City, but three, we totally understood it, too.
Kevin, thank you. His last broadcast was back in 1981. It was sort of an anticlimactic event. Let's listen to his farewell address on the night of March 6th, 1981.
This is my last broadcast as the anchorman of the CBS Evening News. For me, it's a moment for which I long have planned, but which nevertheless comes with some sadness. For almost two decades, after all, we've been meeting like this in the evenings, and I'll miss that. But those who have made anything of this departure, I'm afraid, have made too much. This is but a transition, a passing of the baton. A great broadcaster and gentleman, Doug Edwards, preceded me in this job, and another, Dan Rather, will follow. And anyway, the person who sits here is but the most conspicuous member of a superb team of journalists, writers, reporters, editors, producers, and none of that will change. Furthermore, I'm not even going away. I'll be back from time to time with special news reports and documentaries, and beginning in June, every week with our science program, Universe. Old anchormen, you see, don't fade away. They just keep coming back for more. And that's the way it is. Friday, March 6th, 1981. I'll be away on assignment, and Dan Rather will be sitting in here for the next few years. Good night.
You know, he really downplayed this thing. Was it something of a letdown?
It was a letdown because all of America was watching, and they were thinking he was going to create some big sign-off.
Emotional moment, yeah.
And but it shows you – it sets up for a biographer what's going on there. If you pay close attention, well, Dan Rather will be taking over. I'm on assignment for a few years. Now, if you're the rather crowd, you're coming in, you're hearing, uh-oh, if I don't do well in a year or two, Walter goes a little bit of world beat travel. There might be a public demand to bring him back.
Right.
And
right.
So suddenly Cronkite became an enemy of the rather crowd that we had to divest ourselves of this broadcaster. Just like CBS once, Cronkite had to divest himself of Murrow. Now, he did it as a smoother baton being passed Cronkite, but Murrow's departure from CBS was ugly.
Mm-hmm.
And it ended up being that the Cronkite's departure did not turn out as very well for Mr. Cronkite.
Yeah, because retirement just didn't suit him very well.
I think that's mainly it. I think there was misunderstanding. He thought he was going to be able to come in and be the wise old man. And the rather people cut him off from that. They got rid of his chair, his desk. They essentially decontaminated the CBS newsroom and didn't really appreciate having Cronkite even in the building. Rather,
that just amazed me, the extent to which the rather crowd worked to, as you use the word, decontaminate the set of anything Cronkite related. Man, unbelievable to me.
It's unbelievable to me, too, but that's the way it was.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a part of it was, look, it was a new world media order. Barbara Walters was over at ABC. They were doing a lot more shiny and glitzy sets. You were trying to attract a younger demographic. Rather was going to have to earn his own spurs. But I do want to tell you, Cronkite liked Dan Rather as one of his reporters. They worked brilliantly together in the Kennedy assassination, as we mentioned, but
yeah.
Vietnam. And he actually picked Rather to come over Roger Mudd because Dan had so much international experience. So there was no real bad blood. It was a little bit of a tense relationship because Rather was one of the last of the Murrow boys, and Cronkite and Murrow had a feud.
Mm-hmm.
But it deteriorated quickly by the late 81, 82.
Because the extent to which the Rather crowd was pushing him away. You know, there's even a scene in your book, Doug, where you talk about the first night that Rather took over the broadcast. And on that night, there was literally the producers were counting down from a minute on down to the first seconds that Rather would ascend to the throne and take over the broadcast that Cronkite had led for so many years. And Rather decides at the very last second to do what?
They're literally counting, you know, like 1 minute till show. And he throws a tizzy fit and refuses to sit in the chair because the chair was supposed to – Cronkite's chair was supposed to have been warehoused. But Bob Schieffer worked the Saturday shift and had rebrought the chair back in. And then he was taller than Cronkite, Rather, and it thought that he wouldn't look right in that chair and that he didn't want to be – he wanted a different look for the broadcast so to show the break with the past. So he tried to stand and kind of cross his legs like as if you're sitting on top of a desk. But they did it last minute, and it was awful. And everybody at CBS headquarters said, what is Dan doing? He's botching his first gig, you know, first night. And he quickly reformed and got back into the chair. So it's just an awkward YouTube moment at this point.
Boy, awkward, to say the least. He was fascinated by America's space program. And he was fascinated by space from a very early age. Why? Where did that come from?
Cronkite, during World War II, was worked with the Air Force, as mentioned, went on bombing missions with the Mighty Eighth, and got to know all the pilots and the engineers, space engineers, rocketry experts, kept a Rolodex on those people, and they moved into, you know, Stuart Symington of Missouri was the first Secretary of Air Force in 47. He was a friend of Cronkite,
and he
kept this sort of aviation Rolodex going, so when the space race ensued, Walter seized Cape Canaveral, and he's considered like the eighth astronaut. If you go down to what's known as the Space Coast in Florida, you go in many of diners, and you'll see Cronkite's paper there with Glenn and, you know, Neil Armstrong and all. He was the promoter of NASA, the booster that we can go to the moon, and over us talk, put it in terms of Magellan and Columbus and now Apollo 11 and this. And he may be right. Look, history may show the high water mark of the 20th century was going to the moon when man finally broke its shackles of Earth. Cronkite was a believer in that.
And he desperately wanted to go into space himself, and it never happened.
He was constantly getting in trim. to become an astronaut. And there's a funny a guy
what an image that is.
David Friend from now at Vanity Fair was working for Life and had smuggled out of NASA a suit and got Cronkite to wear it in Edgartown Martha's Vineyard. He was walking around with full space garb on and letting photos be taken, begging his buddies at NASA to put him up there. And he got shortlisted as one of the first That's civilians right. in space. And, of course, John Glenn went up as a senior, and Cronkite wanted to go with Glenn. And that didn't happen. And then you had the explosion of the Challenger and the horror of that during the Reagan years. And mm-hmm. they started rethinking at NASA how many of these civilians you're going to put into space, particularly one who was aging as Cronkite, who had a heart condition. And that, mm-hmm. in the end, I think, is what's ruled him out. But he was really almost up there. He had done all of the paperwork, took physicals and all, to even as a senior up in his 70s and 80s to be shot into space.
And just a final thing, you know, when Kay Barnes, our former mayor, was sitting in this chair, she told me once that Walter Cronkite liked to drive his cars very, very fast.
Very fast. Yeah. He was a speed freak, and he would auto race on weekends. And in fact, he crashed once in the Smoky Mountains, but he would go on these courses up in Connecticut and in New York and almost was making a career out of it. So you see this love of putting the helmet on, getting into the thing. They, when he got the anchor, they made a deal with Cronkite. No more auto racing. We can't have a dead anchor. So he went to the America's Cups race in 62 and took up yachting and sailing instead.
A little safer.
But he could go fast at the seas, but you wouldn't crash.
Doug, I sure enjoyed having you. Thanks for coming in today.
Enjoyed it.
That's historian Douglas Brinkley. His new book, Cronkite, a very good read. He speaks tonight at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Plaza Branch at 6:30. More information about that on our website, kcur.org. On Wednesday, a conversation about uses for ultra-high-speed internet service via Google Fiber. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.